This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We're really quite delighted to have Danielle Allen with us. Anyone who's followed her academic career knows just how accomplished she is. Trained in both the classics and political science, she's now a professor at Harvard and widely respected for her writings on democratic theory, political sociology, and the history of political thought. Already more than a decade and a half ago, when she won a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant, she was being recognized for what the MacArthur folks called combining, quote, the classicist's careful attention to texts and language with the political theorist's sophisticated and informed engagement. Her previous books have addressed issues of justice and citizenship in both ancient Athens and modern America, and have had such titles as The World of Prometheus, The Politics of Punishing in Democratic Athens, Talking to Strangers, Anxieties of Citizenship Since Brown the Board of Education, and Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in Defense of Equality. Her latest book, Cuz, is different. It's a very personal and a very painful story. It makes some very compelling and important larger points about our criminal justice system and the urgent need, in particular, to reform how juveniles who commit crimes are handled. But the power of the narrative comes from the very sad, tragic tale of Danielle's cousin, Michael Allen. At age 15, Michael, who was an engaging teenager with a broad, toothy grin and no previous criminal record, was arrested for an attempted carjacking. He served 11 years and was released at age 26. Danielle tried to help him make a fresh start by assisting with a job search, college applications, and rental housing. But Michael also ended up being drawn into other destructive directions, including the drug trade and quite a corrosive relationship with a girlfriend. He spent just 1 year as a free man before being sent back to jail for a parole violation. He was released again at age 28. At age 29, he was shot to death. A review in Kirkus called Cuz both, quote, a searing memoir and a sharp social critique. And Publishers Weekly described the book as, quote, an outcry and an entreaty. Please join me in welcoming Danielle Allen.
Thank you very much, Brad, for the invitation to be here. And this bookstore is such a famous place and such a miracle. Keep the world of the mind alive. It's a true honor to be here. I appreciate it. It's also a huge privilege to have members of my family here tonight. My dad. See, people in this book are here. This is very strange for me. This is not like I'm a scholar, I'm an academic, so I'm used to writing arguments, you know, point one, evidence, 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 and not to have, you know, the characters in the book sitting there considering whether or not the narrative has been, in fact, fairly told. And my brother, I'm so grateful that he's here. And my cousin's niece, also here, who's in the book as a brilliant runner, a sprinter. And others of my family members, my stepmother and my another cousin. So this is, as I said, this is new for me, to tell a story which is about my family and to share it. And thank you for summarizing the story. Maybe I'll go ahead and start by trying to explain why I wanted to write this book and what I was trying to do. And then I'll read a little bit to introduce you to Michael, give you a feeling for who he was as a person and his voice, and share a little bit about myself in this as well. But the short of it is, Michael was a beautiful, talented, engaging kid, the baby son of the baby daughter of a huge extended family, and he was beloved, just beloved. He brought laughter and joy with him everywhere. And the His arrest at 15, as you might imagine, was a tragedy for the family. And the time in prison was a time of journeying collectively. And there's lots to say about why everything happened in the court process the way it did, and I'll come back to that. But the whole time in prison was a shared journey. Many of us visited. I spent a lot of time visiting. I worked with Michael on college courses. And so, of course, we approached the moment of reentry with great trepidation, but with confidence, crazily. There's no point having confidence at that moment of reentry. But we actually brought confidence to it. We were a big family with resources, lots of people who'd achieved things. We thought we understood the path, hard as it was, and what it would take to help Michael, climbing out at 26, make it. And we failed. He was dead 3 years later, this beloved member of our family. Michael, as I said, was this incredible, talented person. He was a great writer. He loved to write. He spent a lot of time in prison writing. He wanted to be a writer. And we always thought that when he got out, Michael would tell his own story. So another loss when he died was that Michael couldn't tell his story anymore. And I had his letters, and I had essays he'd written in college. And I just had in the back of my mind this question of how was Michael going to tell his story? So the center of this book is an essay that he wrote on Dante's Inferno. Like if you sort of open the book in the middle, like that's what's there. And I sort of feel like what I've done is just write a setting for Michael's story so that Michael could tell his own story. There's also a memoir. He was a firefighter in prison, and it was like the best year of his life was fighting California wildfires, the biggest wildfire in California history. And there's a sort of memoir of doing that, and then there's a rap that's sort of interspersed about it. There's some examples of the different kinds of things he wrote. And so, at any rate, I wanted to tell this story. I have this friend at Harvard, you guys know who he is, Skip Gates, who's a very insistent person. He makes things happen. He invited me to give a lecture series at Harvard called the Du Bois Lecture Series, named after, of course, W.E.B. Du Bois, a great sociologist and political philosopher and thinker. And the charge of those lectures is to say something about the state of affairs for African Americans in this country in the present, in our contemporary moment. And I said yes to these lectures, and I gave Skip, you know, like a really abstract title, like, okay, I'm going to give a lecture on race and justice in the 21st century, or I can give a lecture on political equality and African Americans in the 21st century. And I kept canceling the lecture dates and deferring them and rescheduling. And finally, we got to a point where like they're on the calendar, and Skip's like, you're going to have to give these lectures, kid. You know, you can't kind of keep kicking the can down the road. And as I thought about it, I just knew I could only, there's no way I could possibly pretend to speak about the state of affairs for African Americans in this country now without telling Michael's story. So I decided I would try. And then somebody asked me sort of where I came up with the title, because I think of the title as a one-word poem. And they said, well, was it hard to come up with the title for the book? And the short answer is actually, like, it's the title that made the book. Because I was wrestling, I knew I wanted to tell Michael's story, I knew I wanted to explain how this experience of this one young African-American man could help us understand something about our country more broadly. And it came to me one day, because he called me cuz, and cuz I'm trying to explain things. Because I had all these why questions. Why was he dead? Why had he been in prison for so long? And the worst and hardest one, why had he ended up standing on that street corner holding a gun trying to take somebody's car? And I had to answer those questions. And so the structure of the book is answering those questions, the answer to each of those, because of this, because of that, in the end. And the answers, you know, are complicated. It's not like it's just a sort of single shot answer. The answer is yes, about Michael's choices, but it's also about the constrained choice set that he had and the reason for that constrained choice set. And it's also about the way in which his family didn't do what we could have done by way of understanding all of his circumstances and supporting him through them. And it's also about how the state of California, in its panic over carjacking, accepted great aberrations in the criminal justice system. For example, the three strikes law and the way it was used to exacerbate punishment. But at the same time that there was all these complicated whys, Michael's choices, what the family was doing, what the state was doing, criminal justice and so forth, I also found myself wrestling, feeling like I hadn't quite gotten to the bottom of things. And the thing, I guess, there were a lot of surprises that came out of working on this book, a lot of surprises, because I was interviewing family members, and it's embarrassing to say, but Michael died in 2009, and until I started working on this book, or we, because it was a family project, we hadn't talked about what happened to him, okay? Like, we hadn't. That's crazy. And what I realized was, like, everybody had a different piece of Michael's story, and collectively we could put it together. So the first surprise was just discovering how things could have been visible that we didn't make visible because we didn't talk enough. And we didn't talk enough because this kind of trouble is hard to talk about, and there's a lot of shame that breaks people from talking, blocks people from talking. I had to break through that. But another surprising thing, and I'll come to the third surprise, which was the one I want here, but there's a second one, which is, as I put these pieces together, I was surprised to find how much violence had passed through the life of Michael and his family over the whole of the course of their existence. And again, you know, that hadn't come to the surface because people are ashamed. Like, if they've been abused, they're ashamed. They don't tell people. And then it's harder for people to help. And again, there's that silence there. But so what was the third surprising thing, the most surprising thing? So there's a third meaning to cuz, okay? And I didn't even know it. The third meaning to cuz is it's what members of the Crips call each other. All right? I didn't even know that. And it turned out that at the age of just before 14 to when he got arrested at 15, Michael had started flirting with gangs, both Bloods and Crips, which is a very dangerous thing to do, okay? I mean, and I can explain why that was happening, what was going on, but the point is, I didn't know it. His mother didn't know it. Some people had little snippets of a sense of what was going on, but nobody was sharing those snippets and putting it together. One of my cousins, as I was working on this book, he's the one who taught me this, who said every time Michael called him cuz, it gave him chills, because he grew up in a Blood neighborhood, and he didn't know why Michael didn't have the sensitivity not to call him cuz. All right? So the point is, like, even just this little word, if I had known how to read the environment, could have taught me something about what was going on to Michael, and I couldn't hear it and I couldn't see it. Now why? Why couldn't I hear it? Why couldn't I see it? Okay, now this is the part, you may think this is a stretch as an argument, but I truly believe this is a piece of the story of how the war on drugs has corrupted this country. All right, now let me try to explain this, because I'm making a few steps here, a few leaps. The war on drugs has pushed a whole economy into secrecy. And it's an economy also that connects especially to adolescents. Teenagers already don't like to talk to their parents, okay? Like, you all know that. That is not news. And you add to their world a big illegal activity, and you massively increase the problem of secrecy, hypocrisy, lies, and duplicitousness. Who here, I'm just curious, knows how much Americans spend on illegal drugs every year? Does anybody know? Exactly, like, we don't even know. $100 billion. For the last decade, every year, $100 billion. That's how big the secret world is. That is corrupting of a country's being at its core, to have that much secrecy and illegality. Now, not to mention, of course, if you've got an illegal market that size, the violence that goes along with it, and so forth, all right? But in addition, beyond that, let me just add one more wrinkle to this issue of how the war on drugs affects who we are as a society, right? So if you're gonna lock somebody up in prison for possessing a small amount of marijuana for like a year or 2 years, what are you gonna do to an attempted carjacker? You're gonna put them in prison for 13 years, or as a sentence, or 11 years, right? In other words, if you have an irrational punishment anchoring your sense of proportionality, the whole thing is going to skew to excessive punishment. All right? So what I'm trying to say is there's a whole bunch of things that the war on drugs is doing. So lots of people, when they want to talk about mass incarceration, will say, well, let's end the war on drugs, and that will reduce a lot of the presence of punishment in our collective lives. And then people on the other side will say, well, yeah, but only 14% of people are in prison for nonviolent drug offenses. And what I'm trying to say is that on top of the nonviolent drug offenses that are putting people in prison, you also have, obviously, the violent offenses that flow from that secret and illicit world. You have a system of punishments that have become excessive because they're anchored by punishments, for example, for marijuana use that are irrational. All right. And then on top of all of that, you have a culture of secrecy and duplicity that makes it very hard for people to talk about what they're doing. And in that regard, pull together the necessary pieces of understanding among adults so that adults can help adolescents through a difficult time in their lives. There's a lot more I could say about that. I haven't mapped out the whole of my picture, but the point is, as I was trying to figure out how it was that Michael could be moving in this world in Los Angeles and flirting with these gangs, gangs that were growing more powerful at that time because of the drug business, and getting, you know, needing protection because of the danger in the environment, what became clear to me over time is that we'd made that world. We had made that world of competitive gangs fighting the state fighting back with excessive punishments, and we had made that world with our drug laws. So, I started with a boy, Michael, and a family that didn't see the whole picture, and a family that wasn't equipped when he got out to help him escape the relationships from his prison time. And it led me ultimately to believing that the country as a whole has a family secret that it's got to confront. So, I got into my my rant a little bit. Let me get back to Michael and just share a little bit about him, all right, so you can get more of a sense for who he was. So I want to just read you one little paragraph describing some of the childhood time. So Michael grew up in a family. His mother, Karen, had three children. She was a single mother because she'd left their father who was abusive. She was very hardworking nurse. She worked way up to being a nurse. So, you know, met much time committed to work, never enough money, never enough time to quite get everything together for her kids. But still, she managed to get them into a small house in Highland Park. So let me just describe a little bit of that time. In Highland Park, the rites of passage proceeded according to plan. Michael's beautiful kindergarten teacher, the one with the blonde afro, loved him. He graduated in high style in a white cap and gown. He had gymnastics lessons and played Little League and went to summer camp. To raise the funds for camp, he sold peanuts, so successfully even, that he funded his brother and sister's trips to camp too. The trio would go for 3-week stints in the summer, then they would come home, their mother would do their laundry, and then she would send them off again. They always went together. Michael also had a glorious bicycle, a He-Man bike that he loved, and their house was on top of a hill. He would fly down it barefoot, not yet able to brake, ending up at least once with a swollen eye, with the bike all bent out of shape, having terrified his sister, cousins, mother, anyone who was around. His sister, who was growing into a large-bodied girl and had already developed a mothering instinct, would cry out, "Michael, why don't you put no shoes on?" We visited them often at this house, once a month from 6th to 8th grade. I would go by so Big Roz's girlfriend could relax my hair. The only slightly unusual ritual in Michael's life at this time was Alitots. Since he couldn't have remembered his mother's drinking, his enrollment in the program must have seemed mysterious. Karen's spirit lightens when she talks about their time in Highland Park and how amusing it was to eavesdrop on the kids' Saturday morning Alitot meetings. The trio would gather outside her bedroom door, whispering up a cloud of buzzing bees. They were whispering out their grievances, which, she presumed, were mainly about her. They were a united front, and in this small house, all four of them had 5 years they are glad to remember. So that's childhood of Michael. And now I just want to read you a little bit from his Dante essay. "And like Dante, I am forced to descend lower into hell to achieve a full awakening. I am forced into depression, scarred by obscenities, war after war. But each war that I survive, I am a step closer to a full awakening of self. My hell is no longer demonstrating what I am capable of doing in order to survive. It has become what I can tolerate and withstand in order to live. I cannot help but to judge those around me. I am one of them, but we are far from the same. Like Dante, I am cursed with a spirit of discernment, which allows us to see the truth for what it is. There are most whom I despise, who are truly sick beyond healing, and they should never leave this place. Then there are those who await to fulfill their destiny. I see in them a sincere and apologetic heart for their ill misdeeds. They are the one who will change the world positively, or positively change someone's world. Hell cannot hold the latter of the two opposites, but in time will only spit them back out into society to do what is right. The hell that I live in cannot hold Dante. Hell can test and try oneself, but it cannot hold Dante, and it will not hold me. In the inferno, the dead are trapped forever. Surely the biggest and most important difference in the inferno and my hell called prison is that I have a way out. So I said when I was starting that my first goal was to let Michael's voice be heard and let his story be told. And I want to underscore how important and hard that is. So you all know there's about 2 million people in prison. And that's been true for a lot of years now in this country. And I'm a classicist, so I study ancient history. So I have a long-term perspective on these questions. And I can assure you that the world has never seen a penal system like the one we've built. This is a Made in America special. And we have to face that fact. So you just heard some of Michael's voice. There are millions of voices like that, and we're not hearing them. So I want to say one more thing about why we're not hearing them. And to do that, I have to say a little bit more about myself and why it was that for my own family, it was took us too long to talk about what happened to Michael, took us too long to lift up his story. So to do that, what I'm going to do is share with you two chapters in the center of the book, which are about my experience of visiting Michael in prison. So let's just see, okay. If many of my memories of Michael's time in prison involve coaching him over the phone through his writings about canonical texts, a good portion of the rest involve long visits with him and most often with my Aunt Karen in Norco's bare bones visiting room and prison yard. These visits possessed an emotional rhythm, the sense of steeling yourself against the difficult as you started the early morning drive from LA, the rising anticipation as you got closer, the quiet joy of the visit, and the aching disappointment that inevitably came with departure, with leaving one's loved one still inside. Once one arrived at the prison, visits had an intensely ritualistic quality, the underlying purpose of which is control. You might want to say control of the inmates or control of their families, but that wouldn't seem quite right. The target of the rituals felt more indiscriminate. The object is simply control in its own right. As Michael, known to the system as K10033, wrote, inmates went by numbers, not names, and visiting days were allocated to sets of numbers. Half of the evens on one Saturday, half of the odds on Sunday, the other halves of each set the following week. Before you could even begin to visit, you first had to apply for permission to enter. You had to get your name on the list. This could take months. And then the visits themselves were odysseys. We generally set out at about 4 or 5 in the morning in the half dark of pre-dawn and drove straight toward the rising sun in order to get to the prison by 6:30 a.m. There we would join a line of waiting cars snaking from the parking lot past a row of suburban baseball fields that bordered the prison. This was a good time for heart-to-hearts between Karen and me. At 7:30 a.m., the guards would let a parade of Kias and Hyundais, Chevys and Dodges into the parking lot. And then you would sign in at a lectern at the front of a canopied structure with wooden benches that looked something like a tent revival meeting. Hosts of mainly black and brown women, but white women too, many children, and some men, flitted in the shadows under the canopy. We could take in up to $30 in quarters or singles in plastic baggies, and we always took the maximum. The point of this was to purchase treats for the inmates from the row of vending machines dispensing, as it turned out, quite disgusting, microwavable cheeseburgers and burritos, along with mystery meat plates. It also mattered how you dressed. You couldn't wear blue denim because that's what the inmates wore. You couldn't wear beige or khaki because that's what the guards wore. You couldn't wear tight clothes or clothes that showed cleavage or skirt shorter than 2 inches above the knee or sleeve shorter than 2 inches below the shoulder. If you were dressed wrong, you weren't let in. You always took a backup set of clothes just in case. If there was a focal point of the control, I suppose it was the attempt to target desire. Okay, so now my editor didn't like that chapter. And he didn't like it because it took him a long time to figure out why he didn't like it. We went round and round about it for like months, actually. He kept saying, I don't like it. And I said, why not? I'm so precise. I have all this detail. What do you mean you don't like it? And finally, so he kept saying, well, there's no, you're not in it. We're not hearing your experience. And after we went round and round, I realized he was right. And if you were listening, you'll have noticed I wrote that chapter from the point of using the you will do this, you will do that, not I. I'd written the rest of the book up until that moment saying I over and over again. So then I had to write another chapter. That one's called Visiting 1.0. This is called Visiting 2.0. Time for my own confession. I wrote that last chapter like an academic, which I am. The description of visiting that I gave you wasn't about me. It was about some disembodied you. To write that chapter, I stepped into the perspective of an outside observer, the luxury afforded to academics when they travel the world encountering pain and injustice. To be an academic is to acquire an excuse for not owning the pain you see. Abstraction, distancing, those are my first tools of self-protection, Athena's spear and shield. I will have to try again to describe what visiting Michael meant to me. The fact that I told the story as an academic already tells you everything you need to know. The wound of visiting Michael in prison goes so deep that somehow, even in writing this book, I have found it hard to own up to one simple fact. I went to prison. I was in prison. No, I don't mean that I have been arrested or convicted of a crime. I have avoided that because thus far in life, I have had that combination of goods that the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle thought was necessary for a happy life. Resources, decent character, and luck. My father and mother gave me the first two items from that treasure chest, the Lord my God, whom I believed in as a child, and then did not believe in, and then came to believe in again, as I emerged from periods of great pain, has given me the third. All right, so now you know more about me than anybody other than my husband. My second husband, that is. Our wedding took place barely a month before Michael's murder. But no, I was not in prison as a convict, and this is thanks to my father, my mother, and my God. Yet even as someone who could come and go, I felt the prison's mark, its branding fork. I felt it in my soul, even though all I was there was a day's sojourner. Thanks. So we have time for questions. I think this is it. There's a mic up here for folks who have questions.
Yeah. You made the very brave admission that the family wasn't equipped to help Michael get out. What does it take to be equipped? What did you
learn about that? So part of the story of Michael's, so the first third of the book answers the question of why did he end up dead, basically. And there's this moment in, so I helped, I was there when he was released and was working with him that summer on getting enrolled in school, getting housing, getting a job and so forth. And it looked like it was going brilliantly well. Like, you know, 6 weeks out and he had a job at Sears. He was enrolled in a community college and the community college had a fire technology program which was gonna help him get back to the firefighting he'd been doing in prison. And we found this apartment. Perfect apartment, and it was, you know, a couple blocks from the school. Everything was commutable. It worked beautifully. and the landladies were willing to rent it to him, which was incredible because like that was, you know, taking a chance on a guy. And he said yes. We drove away, and we were going to take the, it was after banking hours, so we were going to take the deposit back the next day. And later the night he called me and said, I don't want the apartment. I was like, what? And so I said, think, you know, sleep on it. Anyway, we went back and forth, 24 hours, like four calls. So he'd say, I do want it, I don't want it, I do want it, I don't want it. Finally said, I don't want it. I don't know what it would feel like if I brought my associates by. And I didn't ask a question about that. But what it became clear was the case was he had a girlfriend from prison, a transgender woman he'd met while he was incarcerated between the ages of 15 and 26. And he was deciding at that moment whether to break off his relationship with her. Now, I ask you, if when you're asking somebody to end the first love of their life, a love that has been quite powerful and provided solace in difficult circumstances, in order to have a fresh start, what are the odds of success? And if you send a kid to prison when they're 15 for 11 years on their first arrest, I mean, I don't really think he had a chance. That's the truth of the matter. So I think you can talk about reentry and you can talk about how people need to be equipped, and they need like housing that's safe, and they need schools and they need jobs and all of that. But the hardest thing is what it means to transition from one set of relationships, which you have needed to survive, to another. And that is just not an easy human thing. We're asking so much, actually, given the length of the sentences we impose on people. We're just basically being irrational about it. That's all I can really see about it, to be honest. Terry?
So the securities that Michael may have developed while he was incarcerated. Oh, sorry. The securities that Michael. It wasn't. Okay.
There you go. Yeah.
Closer.
Yeah.
The securities that Michael.
10-year rock star.
May have developed while he was incarcerated, very different than what he may have felt or may have been offered to him when he was released, or what you could offer as a family. Do you think, or what do you think about maybe that you could have done differently? You might have asked yourself this a million times to help him or change his situation, or if things could have turned out differently.
He loved somebody and he didn't want to give that up. And the person he loved was herself a violent person and connected to a world of violence. And so, you know, I think if we had, the things I wish could have been done differently are more along the lines of, so at that time in California, I think this has actually softened some since then, but at that time you had to be paroled to the county where your offense was committed. Our first round of plans for Michael involved taking him to other places. So my husband and I in Chicago had offered to have him come live with us and put him to school there. And we also had family in Riverside County, which is where he'd been doing the firefighting, as you know, and where he could have gone there. They were also ready to take him in and support him. But the rule was that you had to go back to where you'd been committed your offense, and that was LA County. And you know, it's possible that if we had pursued legal action to fight that, we might have achieved a different landing spot for Michael. So I suppose if there's anything that I feel like we didn't do that we should have done, it was probably that. But I think once he was going home to LA County, it's not as if there, his mother fought, to be just putting it very bluntly, his mother fought for her son, with the girlfriend. Like there was an actual, in effect fight over Michael between them. So it's not as if there wasn't an effort to, pull him out of a set of social relations. But honestly, like, again, I just feel like if you're in prison for 11 years from the age of 15, the depth of the bond you're going to form to the people who help you survive is probably immeasurable.
Hi. One of the things that brought me here is I particularly liked one of your earlier books, Talking to Strangers.
Oh, thank you.
And I was wondering about that in this context, looking for a point of relief, because it's sort of a dire picture.
Right.
Once you get an unreasonable sentence, which I can certainly agree with, it's hard to get out of the cycles which impose themselves. And to end or begin, as you did with standing with a gun, it reduces the sympathy for those who might intervene.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you could apply some of what I noticed in Talking to Strangers, finding the people at the earlier breaking points, not necessarily in that book, but mm-hmm. Who could you talk to, or what are the people that might, what are the intervention points? Obviously, there's social policy. We can all expect miracles from Trump and other things, but short of that, is there somebody in the immediate cycle that there's a vulnerability that Michael may have brought to your attention?
No, thank you. That's a great and important question. And so things I have learned things from Michael that I think are worth, you know, building on in that way. So like age 10 to 14, like that is the most important time period. And kids just, they really need stability. So Michael, you know, moved like 5 times in 5 years in that period, moving schools 5 times in the middle of the year. Like that is clearly the point when everything went wrong. His mother married. Right? You think you're sort of solving the single mother. She married somebody abusive, and the whole thing just exploded. And so she had been kind of incrementally moving her way up and stabilizing her family, and then it just like ripped to bits. And like that was those years for Michael. And I think at the end of the day, that's sort of, you know, the thing to focus on. And so like, as a family, we needed to have been more attentive to that stage of life and to have seen the degree of disruption. We weren't seeing it all. We weren't hearing about all the violence. And this is what I mean about the talking piece. So it's partly focusing on 10 to 14. It's figuring out how adults can break through the shame of talking about hard things so that the full story is there so people can help and be equipped to help. There's another thing that I learned from Michael is, so he loved to be outdoors, just loved to be outdoors. And he had this one kind of great year of his life in prison. That sounds like a crazy thing to say, but people do achieve things in prison. It's not just, you know, a sort of domination and oppression. Like there can be achievement in that context. And it was this year of fighting fires and writing these great essays in college. And those things went together for him. He needed that physical outdoor time to focus and concentrate the academic time as well. These things needed to go together. And I have a little boy who loves to be outside. He just loves it. You can just see it in him. He reminds me of Michael. And I've got to figure out how to make sure he gets that outdoor time and can, in a structured way, not roaming the streets, right? Enjoy it and grow in that alongside his academic work. So things like that. But again, it's like thinking about age 10 to 14, you know, we're not doing right by adolescence.
Yes, and as a result of your experience, is your sense, I mean, you said there were many people in prison like Michael, and I wondered overall, do you think of prison generally as full of Michaels, or are there people who are with Michael but going across a broader range of problems and issues and difficulties and what have you, so that it's a variety of people in trouble for different reasons?
Yeah, I mean, I would never stand up here and tell you there were 2 million Michaels in prison, but there's a lot of Michaels in prison. So yeah, I mean, I do not think this is an isolated story. There are a lot of talented, engaged, curious people in prison who, again, it's sort of like this age. So one of the things that was really striking to me about as I was working on this and I was doing research in sociology as well as just interviewing family members was the literature on gangs and how kids get involved in gangs. And, you know, the literature has a consensus. Kids start flirting with gangs often in this sort of 10 to 13 age range, they typically start flirting with gangs for the sake of protection because they need protection from dangers in the environment. And then within 18 months of starting to flirt, they have their first arrest. I was like, Michael's pattern to a T. And so there's, you know, the number of people getting caught up at that point, yeah, there's a huge number of Michaels. I think once you're in a kind of repeat situation, there's just a heck of a lot of degradation of the spirit and capacities and so forth. So I think it does get very hard, but there's, you know, especially with, you know, how we think about juvenile justice and so forth. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of Michaels in our prisons.
Okay, not the only ones, but
a
lot of
them. Not the only one. There's a lot. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you, Tanya. I want to come back to something that you said in your introduction, which really struck a chord. You said that the family had a secret and that the country has a family secret that it has to confront. And I want to ask whether you think that the country is actually interested in confronting the secret, because as we know, the prison system is a very lucrative business and all that goes with the enslavement of people that continues.
So when I gave these lectures, when I gave this as a lecture, the Stars had three lectures, which was, believe you me, a very crazy experience for all involved, because, you know, all these folks came to a set of academic lectures, and I stood up there and I just wept for three lectures straight. And everybody was incredibly generous to me in receiving that and being responsive to me. But one of the things that was most remarkable to me was the number of people who came up after the lectures, white as well as black, and said, I have a family member in prison and I've never told anybody. And honestly, like, if you just stop and think about it for 2 seconds, that's completely obvious, right? Like, 2 million people in prison this year, 2 million people in prison last year, 2 million people in prison the year before. Like, every one of those people is connected to 2 to 10 to 20 other people. So yeah, like, there's a huge part of our population that is directly affected by this story, but none of us are telling the stories. So the world of policy is complicated. There is actually a bipartisan push on these questions now, which is hope bringing. But I think more importantly, there actually is a huge human story here, which if we could just get it out, I think things would change fast.
Hi. So I guess I was just wondering how you managed to write through your own grief.
Well, you know, partly I'm kind of like slightly oblivious, which is probably how I ended up as an academic in the first place. It's like I sometimes like don't know that things are going to be hard before I start doing them. Like this, for example, like with my family sitting here, like it didn't occur to me I was going to have to like stand up in front of people with my family sitting here and talk about these things. Honestly, I don't know why I don't think about these things in advance. So, before I started, I asked Michael's mother and his siblings for permission. That was the necessary thing. And I spent a lot of time talking to them about Michael's life. And as I said, we hadn't ever done that. And so it was hard and it hurt, but we needed it. And I am very grateful to my aunt, who describes this whole process as being a liberation for her and peace bringing. So the difficulty was always countered by just the sense of like finally having answers and achieving them together and talking as a family and coming to understand each other and the value of that.
Thank you so much for addressing the shame. It's hardly anything harder to do than that. And my question is, isn't part of our country's family secret is the refusal to seriously question what is it in our society that is so cruel and lacking compassion to so many, that so many are driven mm-hmm. to self-medicating from right. opioids to whatever.
Right.
And isn't part of that secret also is a refusal or denial of it by projecting the problem off on the, those that we send to prison for inordinate terms.
Yep.
I mean, and the criminality of sending a 15-year-old to jail for 14 years. I mean, what about our own criminality being part of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely like there's a very serious amount of repression going on in our country around these issues. I mean, I would add to that, for all of our engagement with foreign policy conversations, the one we never have is about the disintegration of Central and South America caused by the drug wars. We just don't talk about it, people. Ah. So yes, thank you for that.
Hi, thank you so much for your book and for writing it and for putting yourself out there in that way. And I just wanted to ask if you have heard of or read anything by Reginald Dwayne Betts?
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. Anyway, sorry, finish your question.
Well, if you hadn't heard about him, I would yeah. recommend that the two of you meet. But any case,
yeah.
it sounds like you know him, so that's great.
I met his book first. I met him after there was an excerpt of my book in The New Yorker. So Dwayne Betts also, he was convicted of a carjacking when he was 15 in Virginia. He was sentenced to 8 years, I believe. He's now a graduate of Yale Law School, and he's doing a PhD at Yale Law School, and he's passed the Connecticut Bar Exam. Though he is not being permitted to practice law in Connecticut because of his felony conviction. So there's, in fact, a petition.
Yeah,
under.
He signed it.
Okay. But, and he wrote a book about his own experience, which was valuable to me as I was working on this, because I had Michael's letters and I had his essays and I had all my conversations with him, but they're three things probably that matter about conversations with an inmate. I mean, one is, you know, everything is surveilled. So phone conversations, there's a lot of stuff you don't talk about, ditto when you're visiting in prison. And then you never talk about what any given inmate's fellow inmates have done. Like that's just a complete taboo. And also then once a person's out, they never want to talk about what it was like to be in. So actually understanding the full violence and brutality of the experience of being in prison is very hard. And so Dwayne's book was helpful to me because I read it and like oblique things that Michael said to me, I was like, ah, like that's what he was talking about. And I could kind of like hang little phrases Michael had given me on the structure of Dwayne's narrative. And I also realized, so I recommend his book to everybody. I'm gonna forget the title of it now, but Dwayne Betts, B-E-T-T-S is his name. And I realized too, like, so he'd written the inmate's experience book, and I'd written the woman's, like the visiting women, the mothers and the cousins and the sisters. Like that's the book that I had written. So our books belong together. I mean, they should be read as pairs. And he read the excerpt from The New Yorker, and he wrote me, actually. And it is one of the most beautiful thank you notes I've ever gotten.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
I guess my question is, what pearls of wisdom can you share with families that are going through, or when the kids get out? What did you learn from this? What's the takeaway for us so that we're not grieving
right.
the mishaps of
right? I think the sort of breaking through I just listed all these taboos. Gotta break through the taboos that block full conversation. I mean, if we were just talking about the families trying to work through issues, if just that level, not sort of the policy question, I think it really is breaking through all the layers of silence that have become a habit and that prevent people from seeing. So even at the end of Michael's life, his mother and sister both had a sense that things were going badly wrong, that he was getting pulled into more violence. But even so, they didn't really know. And they didn't really ask questions. And they didn't even really talk to each other about what their worries were. And so over and over again, as I was working on this, I just felt like I was seeing, you know, everybody had, it's like the iceberg. Like everybody had a visibility on the kind of top part of the iceberg, but not the stuff underneath. But they could have, like we could have. And it just required a very different approach to communicating, like within the support network around the person, like thinking that kind of coordinated care, like just like really kind of fulsome, like sharing every single worry, every bad thing, every shameful thing you've spotted, sharing that, and figuring out how to try to pull the person you're caring for into those practices of honesty. Because otherwise, in the world, it's about like keeping the world of prison separate from the other world, and like that's part of a survival strategy. It's like just like put all that stuff in a box and so forth. But then like because it's in a box, it's impossible on the outside world to like address the issues that still come from what's in the box. So you can't keep them separate, actually. I think that's the hardest thing.
Yeah. Hi. You had mentioned that the rule that people be paroled into the, was it the county where they were arrested or convicted? Or
yeah, exactly.
That has relaxed somewhat since?
That's my understanding in California.
What was the impetus for that? Was it litigation or has there been any sort of meaningful reform?
That's a good, so California has been pursuing reform in various ways, right? So they just legalized marijuana in the last election. They have softened the three strikes, you're out laws. And they have been pursuing reductions of prison overcrowding. So they have a set of reforms that they've been working on, and I think continue to move forward in that direction.
That's good.
Yeah.
Hi, I teach students with mental illness, and so a lot of times we as a school system rely on the juvenile criminal justice system to be our punishment. You know, we have a student who may have a psychotic break and may threaten somebody or throw a desk or something like that, and the answer to that is, oh, you need to go see a judge. What other things can we do to prevent a Michael?
Right. So I mean, I guess I want to say two things, and one is coming back to the kind of coordinated care issue, and then the other comes back to the issue of drug policy. So on the coordinated care side, I mean, I've articulated that idea for families, but it's also something that pertains to schools and all kinds of contexts where, and it's hard because it takes resources to build, you know, even like sometimes some people are doing it with databases, right, where as people observe things about kids, it all goes into the same database, so people have a kind of richer understanding of what's going on in their lives. But it is doable. I mean, there are things that organizations can do to be better at that also. Mm-hmm. But then on the policy side, so I didn't completely finished the sort of thought I was articulating about the war on drugs, so I would add two other things to it. So to say that we've built this world of penality with the war on drugs, it's part of the story. Then there's the question, well, what do you do about that? And you know, I do think that we should legalize marijuana, and I think we should decriminalize heroin and cocaine. This is going to be a long answer, but I will come back to your question. and there's a distinction between legalization and decriminalization, right? So legalization means it's like alcohol. Decriminalization means you get a misdemeanor, not a felony, if for use and possession. Trafficking is still felonious, criminal. And the point of this is that you can then transition to thinking about use as a health problem. Mm-hmm. And in general, use a public health and health and well-being paradigm for thinking about addiction treatment, harm reduction, and things like that. So Portugal has tried this, and the results in Portugal have been increase of people seeking treatment, decrease in adolescent drug use. So the point is not that, the way this comes back around to answering your question is, the drug laws have been a huge driver of growth in the criminal justice system in terms of just plain dollars invested. So 32% of case filings in 2013 in federal courts were drug cases. It's the biggest category of filings. Every state judicial system has had to like add resources to deal with the drug laws. And it's like we deal with everything, every problem, like we use the criminal justice hammer to hit it because the thing has just grown so big, like that's where the money is. And it's like if you want to change that, you have to figure out how to shift the dollars from criminal justice to health resources. Mm-hmm. And I think a way to do that, I mean, there are people experimenting with diversion programs in lots of places. So rather than connecting a kid or, you know, even a sort of adult with a problem, a mental health problem or a drug problem, you know, to the criminal justice system first, you have, there's like a list of providers where you go first, and you try to make sure that you're using a health paradigm for thinking about the issue. And then the, you know, the notion is like over time that starts to drive resources away from criminal justice into the health services. Cool. That was a long-winded answer, I apologize. Thank you so much, I appreciate it.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.